you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have David Wimhoff back on the show. He returns to discuss his article, The State of the Union. Of course, David is a lawyer practicing in South Bend, Indiana. He is also an author. He wrote John Courtney Murray, Time, Life, and the American Proposition, How the CIA's Doctrinal Warfare Changed the Catholic Church. His website is The American Proposition, which is dedicated to, I guess, highlighting or kind of that book and other topics related to the issue of Americanism, the Catholic Church, and you know what's going on in America and these things. So, Mr. David, how are you doing this evening?
Well, I'm okay. I just came back from a talk that was given by John Allen, the Catholic commentator and reporter and watcher of the Vatican, as I'm sure a lot of your listeners know. He gave a talk to a packed house at Holy Cross College here at Notre Dame, Indiana, and I was sad.
What saddened you about the talk?
Well, I walked in and the place was filled with people. These are good people. They mean to do well. They mean to know the right thing to do. They mean to get along. They want to know the truth. They want to be good. And I kind of saw myself, in a way, as I was 15 years ago or so, where you turn to the accepted voices of Catholicism to try to understand what's going on. And all you get is some sort of pandering and misdirection. That's what you get. And that's what I got tonight from John Allen. It was pandering and misdirection. Oh, yeah, we all laughed. He told the jokes, you know, got everybody laughing. And he made a number of funny stories and got everybody kind of nodding. Yep, that's right. And harkened back to their own experiences and in life, you know, to try to understand what he was saying, to illustrate his point. But I guess some of us just know too much. And so we hear this, and we have to ask a question. What's he really trying to say? Or more importantly, What is he trying not to say? Now, what I found most interesting about the start of his talk is something that I and others, especially former ambassador to the Vatican, Rooney, have concluded, which is, and I think this is obvious to all of us, that the United States is the most important country in the world. He called it the most important hard power in the world, per Harvard professor Joseph Nye. And then Mr. Allen said that the Roman Catholic Church is the, quote, most important soft power, quote, in the world. That's right. It is. And he says it's important for everybody that the most important soft power and the most important hard power get along with each other and, quote, understand each other, end of quote. So right away, I thought about my cousin Guido, you know, who said to the guy on the corner, hey, now, if you do what I say, I will break your knees, okay? Do we understand each other? We got an understanding here. Oh, yeah, Guido, I think we do. So right away, you're hit with this idea that these two entities are somehow joined to each other. But who's got the most power? Well, my book says the most power came from America, because America had the ability to effectively shape people's minds and thoughts and perceptions. And the church, in large measure, has and continues, and I should say the church leadership, has and continues to let the American mind manipulators manipulate their minds and control them and tell them that America teaches the church. And so the doctrine of the Catholic Church is put on hold, and whatever comes out of New York or L.A. or Washington, D.C. is what you have to believe. And that's the truth, and that's what we got to deal with. And the way it works is that you have a pope like Francis who gets up there and makes these comments to the media. Like in May of 2016, he said, oh, yeah, the confessional state doesn't work. We need a secular state. Well, that's not Catholic doctrine. And then he says, oh, but, you know, when asked about gays and gay sex, he says, oh, who am I to judge? Well, what's he doing when he says that? Yeah, he's throwing Catholic doctrine under the bus. What he's saying, too, to the faithful is he's saying, yeah, you can go along with what the secular media says is right and good. But most importantly, he's signaling to the powerful private interest, the 1%, and he's also signaling to elements within the church that this is what we want you to believe. That's what the powerful 1% want you to believe, that gay is good and the secular state, liberalism, capital L, the American ideology as a way to organize society is good. That's the signal. That's what John Courtney Murray did. He was the messenger from the elites in America, and increasingly is becoming a global elite, but he was the messenger to the church leadership saying, hey, buddy, let's try to understand each other here. That's what he was saying. He was saying, you go along with this way, you're going to look good, and nothing bad's going to happen to you. And I don't mean any insult to the Italian-Americans out there. I'm referencing the mafia. You know, but that is when you say we have an understanding, you know, well, boy, what does that really mean? Well, it means somebody has to have the ultimate power. And the people with the ultimate power is the American elites. They've got the power because they've got the most powerful government, most powerful country on the face of the earth. They got hard power. And the reality is that the proper employment of violence in the form of war, as has been employed by the United States for a number of years, and other countries too, is actually very effective. It works. And people know that. So that's why I came back sad. So what does that have to do with the State of the Union? It basically I'm saying in my article is that you've got this titanic struggle, which is starting to manifest itself in America. And really, the deciding force of that struggle could be the Catholic Church. Even John Allen tonight said, the United States is crucial to the Catholic Church. And likewise, the Church is crucial to the United States. But what that means is that U.S. Catholics exert more influence throughout the Church than the other 1.23 billion Catholics around the world. That's a reality. And that is a reality that is not lost on a lot of people in the Vatican and in America. And that's why American Catholics are so important. And if the leadership of the Church would ever decide to go back to its doctrine and dogma and do its mission, it could affect real and positive change for everybody. But they're not interested in that. They just want to cater to the 1%. So what you got in America is this growing division. And you have to understand that it's rather unclear. I mean, you've got elements in one camp and other elements in the other camp, but it's kind of this struggle between this individualistic universal ideology versus some conception of the natural law and how to organize society and how to live society. And I think in the natural law camp, you got, you know, largely the pro-lifers, the anti-contraception people, if there are any anymore, that they're in there. You know, the anti-gay marriage people are kind of in there because they're believing in a society where laws are based on the law of God. Well, it depends on how you define God, I suppose. But still, there's an idea that you have a God. You have an entity which is above man, and you're supposed to organize your life in accordance with that entity, you know, like the hearth and the altar of the ancients. You know, we know there's a God there. We got to please him. We better follow his laws as best as we know them. And this was the same idea in the Old Testament, in the old country of Israel, with the prophets, when they said to the wealthy, to the 1% in that day, they said, hey, you guys are not following the law of God. Your policies are supposed to be based on that. This is a common conception all throughout human history. But America has this other group that says, well, it's ideological. We don't have to follow God's rule. It's individual ideological beliefs. And they, you know, they stand for whatever the individual wants. And that manifests itself in terms of, you know, gender identity, you know, if you want to have an abortion, if you want to practice contraception, you know, even to the point of you know, defining, picking your own religion and living however you want to live. Okay, that is really part of their ideology. Now, that kind of overlaps where these two camps still seem to agree is they seem to agree that the system in America is the best system, the best political system for resolving disputes. But what you have is potentially two vastly different worldviews. And world history is filled with instances of conflagrations between these different views, of wars fought between these different views. So democracy is there, and the political system is there to keep people from going to war. Because if they go to war, it's going to be bad. The system failed in 1860 because you had an entire group of states secede and declare their independence. Now, the issue of independence was up for some grabs back then. That's been since resolved by a Supreme Court decision after the war, because we were not going to throw away a million lives saying, oh, well, you know, you can still secede. So that they had to make that decision. But that is what you're faced with. You're faced with the situation where there's this tension. And what is making it interesting is to watch the pundits, like William Galston, who writes for the Wall Street Journal. He's also a Brookings Institute fellow. And he came to Notre Dame November 27th of last year. And he said, you know, what's different now is there are parts of the country that are strongly blue and other geographic parts that are strongly red. And this division is becoming more and more geographically oriented. That's a dangerous dynamic to have in any society, because when you have territory and ideas and beliefs tied in with that territory, it's a lot easier for conflict to arise. So you've got a very, very difficult situation, I think, in America. The involvement of people in the system is essential to keeping it going, especially when everybody agrees on the system of organization. When people drop out, as they were doing in 2015 before Trump announced his presidency, and by the way, I think a major reason for him running for president was to get people involved back in the system, because he saw the people breaking away. And when people don't believe in the system anymore, they're going to turn to violence, or they're going to turn to other means of resistance. And so he saw that, he got people involved in the system, but he can't keep getting reelected. He can't keep the drama going in Washington. Somebody else has to get in there, or maybe nobody at all. But you know, maybe nobody will replace it. It'll just be the same old business as usual. So this is what I see, and this is what I saw when you look at the State of the Union when he gave the talk February 5th in the House. You could see these blocks of people. I mean, we've seen that in other states of the Union, but it's become even more apparent. And what's interesting is the individualists, the liberals with the small L, they use the idea of community, of group solidarity, to attack the ideas on that are held by the people who are more of a natural law party, you know, more of the red state. So the kind of, you know, the blue is kind of using the idea of community or the natural law to attack the people who are trying to hold to natural law for this idea of a general society. But everybody seems to agree on the system. Everybody seems to agree on the political system. They think it's the best. They think that liberalism, capital L, is a way to go. But they're having problems. And we're starting to see it, especially with the rise in factionalism.
Yes.
That's a long discussion for an opening, I know.
Yeah, I'm obviously, if you ask someone how better to settle disputes in society, you want ballots over bullets. But that's assuming, deep cultural divide that's been created in the United States in the past 50, 60 years, whether the union can be maintained under such terms. But you in the article, list certain existential threats to this liberal order. And I do listen to the speech after it, didn't watch it live, but I listened to it later on. And the president is making the typical claims: opportunity for all, increased employment for women and minorities, I guess.
Right.
As if, you know, I guess more women working is a good thing. I don't know. That's the liberal presuppositions that he's using. But you mentioned some of these threats. Now, one threat you list is ethnic consciousness. Can you explain?
Yeah, I think that liberalism has always found an enemy in the nation. The idea of a nation, of a group of people who are united by history, by culture, by geographic location, and by blood. That's a very real factor. And we're talking blood, we're talking necessarily race. Race is a factor in forming a nation. The Catholic Church and Catholic doctrines always recognize that. And it's not the factor, but it is a factor. And it's one that has to be considered in determining an ethnicity. So America came about, you had people from all over Europe living in this country. It was mostly Scottish, mostly English. So it was that cultural overlay which lasted for a while. But that was gradually replaced as other groups came in and they were largely absorbed. If you wanted to move up in America, you had to give up your ethnic roots. Now, that wasn't always the case entirely in places like Chicago and New York. You could still keep your ethnic roots. You could get elected to office. You could still rise to a certain level. That's right. You could, and economically too. You could rise to a certain level. But you weren't going to be let into the silk stocking crowd. That's for sure. Because those were people who, yes, they may have had a similar background and they've been largely Presbyterian or WASP, but they also had a very secular worldview. And they did not want, an ethnic state. They wanted the universal individualism that Thomas Paine wrote about, that the other founders talked about, because that is how best you can create wealth and grow wealth and concentrate wealth, is when all the barriers are broken down. This is what Amintore Fanfani talked about, and I've talked about this before, and that's what he wrote about in his book, Catholicism, Protestantism, and Capitalism. Capitalism, which is the enjoyment and the accumulation of wealth, is always intent on breaking down barriers.
That was written in the 1920s?
1935. It's got to break down the barriers. You've got to allow the free flow of people and goods and services and capital across boundaries. And guess what? 9 years later, what happened? 1944. You had the creation in July of that year with the Bretton Woods Conference of the whole post-war idea and structure that is going to be based on this idea of free trade.
This is like General Agreement of Tariffs and Trade, the the dollar standard under the Bretton Woods system that John Maynard Keynes and Harry Dexter Whitehead, a Stalinist communist spy, created.
Well,
obviously that's the dialectic of the Cold War, but it just, to me, it betrays that dialectic because it shows how they're all working together. Yeah.
Because they're materialistic. There's no law of God. It's a positivistic law. So who determines the positivist? Who determines that? Well, in countries like the United States, it's the powerful private interest, because they've got the money and the means and the people and the resources and the protection of law, and they can do it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're smart. They know how to do it. In the Soviet Union, no, it was a guy with a gun and a club, you know, pretty crude. But in the United States, it's much more sophisticated, and it's easier for people to go along with it.
Yeah, it's the same way how it's being sold in China differently, too, now. You know, so.
Right.
Yeah, it takes a local flavor or color, but it's the same thing, yeah. So there's liberalism. Liberalism, it breaks down, it's the path to globalism, as you said, it breaks down barriers. But America, you know, when Fanfani wrote his book in 1935, and also we mentioned how America had these ethnic enclaves. You could have the sort of this compromise or sort of alchemy that had happened with ethnic Americans, and America was highly decentralized, especially relative to today. And so there seemed to be sort of a modus vivendi that was struck for a little while in America, where you still had strong localism in these things, but inevitably it was just worn down by the forces of globalism, you know, preaching the doctrine of liberalism.
Well, the doctrine of liberalism, the American ideology, started at the top.
Mm-hmm.
And that started, and that had to take a while to percolate through. And also, too, it's always getting this pushback from these ethnic groups. You know, this ideology, you know, is afraid of this ideology of liberalism is afraid of nationalism. So if it's afraid of nationalism, and it's the enemy of this nationalism, well, then there's going to be, you know, some kind of fight or struggle or period of time before it can wear down or co-opt or destroy the ethnic groups that are in that country, whether they exist in a few blocks or whether they exist in an entire city, mm-hmm. or whatever. So these were the old European ethnicities that came in. They're still there in some sense, but they've been largely Americanized. A Polish American is a lot different from a person from Poland who's Polish.
Mm-hmm.
You can see it. The way they act, the way they talk, the way they carry on, totally different. And what you've got instead is you got this white identity, which was partly the creation, you know, of the elites, but they helped to create it because people lived in this common area, and to advance and to live, you had to get along with everybody. So you became a European American.
Yeah, and at the same time, I guess, E. Michael Jones writes about this in Slaughter of Cities, is the creation, the destruction of the urban neighborhoods through Integration was a weapon, a progressive cover for something to break up the neighborhoods. The creation of the interstate highway system. Urban renewal was another excuse, and these things that got people into suburbia. And once they're into suburbia, out of their parish, in these enclaves, they become sort of this deracinated white Americans who have no identity other than what they consume, which, of course, the system is readily there to offer with credit, with debt. So,
well, do you have children?
Yes, I just had my seventh. We just had our seventh a couple months ago.
Well, congratulations. Do you want a better life for them than you've had?
Yeah, I want them to be healthier, smarter, and wealthier. But
they got you.
I know.
They got you, buddy.
I know.
You're in.
But
it doesn't matter where you live. You're going to go where you can get that, and you're going to make sure your kids have that. And that's the lesson of liberalism. And yeah. Where's the Catholic Church been on that? Whereas 240 years of liberty in this country led the Catholic Church, and how many people are being converted over here, and how much are the laws in line with Catholic doctrine and Catholic dogma, Tim?
We're not a Christian.
How much does freedom work here? How well is it really working for the Catholic Church over here?
Yeah, that's the trap, the Faustian bargain we all make with progress, right? Material progress in America, yeah. The good life, and that's the sell, right? That's how they get you. The idea of upward mobility in these things, but what does it matter if you gain the whole world and lose your souls? People really don't ponder that question. They're familiar with it, but they don't really think about it because every day they make compromises. Think how many parents knowingly send their daughters off to college, knowing that leading to their spiritual and psychological ruination. But they want them to have that college degree so they have upward mobility. Same with their sons, you know. But they're still stuck to the system.
And you have to accept that this system is somehow morally good. Otherwise, you're not going to participate in it. And that was the role of John Courtney Murray. But more importantly, John Courtney Murray was the messenger, as I said earlier. He was the messenger to the church leadership saying, hey, we need to get an understanding here. Okay? The big boys in America want you to believe in a certain thing. Okay? And not play up some other stuff, you know? And that's how everybody got along. That's the understanding.
Yeah, that's how you get the good job and have the good life, you know, the upper middle class life that Americans consider to be their birthright.
Right. And you're not going to advance in America if you really hold to Catholicism, to the Catholic doctrine. You won't advance.
But how many Catholics are on the Supreme Court? Come on.
Well, six at last count.
They outnumber the Jews, so we're in control.
Well, and you would think that, you know, what was it, Louisiana, that abortion statute that came up for review in Louisiana, yes. Or was it Kansas? You would think they would have reviewed it, and there was their opportunity to get rid of Roe versus Wade. That's not what it's about.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, obviously, I remember back in 1992, it was Kennedy, right? Who, in the Planned Parenthood versus Casey, rendered that decision about the meaning of freedom, right? Is the meaning to yep. determine that your whole meaning of the universe, which is like, whoa.
That's right.
you will be like God, I guess, right?
Well, but think about that practically. Because mm-hmm. if there's one principle that infuses American life, it's practicality. And practicality says, have no principles other than those that will achieve the goal. Okay? So what is the practical value of people holding that philosophy? I guarantee you that the elites don't believe in that crap, but they'll believe in that crap. They'll let you and everyone else out there believe in it.
Yeah.
Because that gets everybody jumping around like cats on a hot tin roof. And you know what that means? That means they're not focused on the issue. But more importantly, what does that mean? It means there's an opportunity here to make money. Lots of it. And anybody can be in that elite if you're smart enough and you're willing to check enough stuff at the door. You can make it. You can be up there too with the Jeff Bezos's and the Gates and you know, the Forbes 400. You can be up there too. And of course, go to church on Sunday, go to Mass on Sunday. You know, we got this understanding, and give them some money for the priest retirement fund, and they're not going to talk about anything serious. I mean, when was the last time you went to church and you heard a homily that challenged anything?
Well, they might lose their tax exemption if they do that.
They might lose their tax exemption. They might get people upset at them.
Yep.
They might get the most important people upset at them.
Yeah.
But aren't they called to be witnesses and to be martyrs?
Well, that's...
Yeah, maybe not.
Well, that's stuff's, you know, that's history. But, what you're saying is that if you brush aside objective morality, internal truths, you clear the way to pursue a career, to do what has to be done in order to acquire material wealth. And of course, this is the doctrine of the oligarchs. But the oligarchs really don't mean to give us freedom; they give us the ideas of liberalism, radical individualism to enslave us, though, because because through that rhetoric or through those ideas, we're denied the benefits of community, the strength we get from community, from living in a certain place, having a certain identity, attachment to the soil, a certain culture that comes from that. So you can universalize everything and leave all of us as individuals atomized and naked before the corporate state to be enslaved.
Well, but it's a pretty good life over here, isn't it, Tim?
Yeah, that's the so far. And you one thing you mentioned in the article is that one of the other existential threats is that the fact that the system may not be able to produce the wealth necessary to make everyone content and not questioning the system.
So what happens when you can't produce? Well, change that. The wealth is being produced.
Mm-hmm.
It's really just not being shared.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, it's being redistributed differently, yeah.
It's being redistributed,
mm-hmm.
or it's being distributed a certain way. So what you got to do is you got to eliminate some of the underclass. The whole contraception campaign decimated the people living in Appalachia. Did you know that? It just decimated that population. It destroyed that whole culture, okay? Because they did contraception and they got material, they got educated, they were materialistic, they were gone. Now, some people could argue it wasn't a good culture, but all the same, it's an example
mm-hmm.
of what can happen. And that's what's happening here. You've got people in this society, white and black, who are limited in their abilities. That's the reality. They are limited in their ability. Nothing wrong with that. It's just the way it is. Not everybody can do everything. Most importantly, not everybody can be an entrepreneur, because that is what liberalism encourages. Liberalism strengthens, liberalism protects, and it helps, is the entrepreneur. And ultimately, the entrepreneur is concerned about the bottom line and about profits and about money. That's what the entrepreneur is concerned about. So what you got is, if you got to concentrate this wealth, which is what liberalism does, you have all these people out there that really, you know, can't add to anything. So they need to eventually be done away with. And, you know, it's got to be a gradual way of doing it, and they got to do it by their own hand. But that's how you cull the herd, you know, you winnow the crop. That's how you do it. You know, they do it themselves. They do it by a constant downplay of their identity. They do it by constant attacks on their identity, by being called bad people, negative people. If you're a white person and you're lower class, you're really in trouble. Now, the black people, in reality, they are also going to be in trouble in time. And what we're seeing is the rise of the machines, just like in the movie The Terminator.
Yeah.
You're seeing AI, you're seeing these machines are coming in. They're going to take the place of people who do repetitive, non-creative work. But that was work all the same that gave those people a chance to live. And if you're a Christian or somebody who holds to any religion, which believes that, you know, life is sacred and that we all have the dignity and right to life and to live a good life, well, then you should be able to work, you know, even if it's repetitive, uncreative work. Because you know what? Not everybody's creative. Not everybody can paint the next Mona Lisa or come up with the next iPhone, okay? But we can do work and live virtuous lives. And that's according to Catholic doctrine. So what's going on is you're seeing the winnowing of the herd. You're seeing classes of people because of their socioeconomic status being eliminated. You can move up. If you're a lower class white person, you can move up into that elite. But boy, I tell you what, you got to change the way you think, and you got to accept that ideology, lock, stock, and barrel. And you got to go with that and be willing to let your own people go, cut your attachments to whatever religious doctrine there is and whatever ethnic doctrine or ethnicity you may have. And basically then what you do is you see the ideology as good. And you can hold a religious belief as long as that religious belief approves that ideology. Now, here's what's interesting. The other day, I work in South Bend, Indiana. I don't live in South Bend, Indiana, but I work there. And we have the mayor called by the name of Pete Buttigieg. Have you heard of him?
Yeah, he's the, he's the homosexual mayor.
Well, he's gay.
Yeah.
That's what they call him. He's gay. He's gay. And he's running for president. But he had an interesting discussion with Mike Pence. It was really kind of funny. Well, it wasn't with Mike Pence, but it was he said something about Mike Pence's religion. He said, Mike Pence's view of sexuality is such and such. And the way I read the Bible, it's such and such. So what you got are these public figures. This is at the heart of America. These public figures telling the people what their religion is. And where are the bishops? Where are the priests? They're silent. Because if they speak up, oh, guess what? The bank owner happens to be a nominal Catholic, isn't going to fund your projects or isn't going to help you. Or just won't be happy with you. And your career may end, Bishop so-and-so. So that's what's going on. And it's an economic shifting. They're winnowing the herd. And you get this going on in a very subtle way. But, of course, it's always masked. It's always cloaked. And you never clearly see what it is. But this is what you have with Pete Buttigieg and Mike Pence, you know, two public figures telling you what to believe. That's what the prayer breakfasts are about.
Yeah.
You know, it's the public officials telling you what you can believe. And if you don't believe that, well, then somebody must be asleep somewhere, because that's what's going on. They're telling you what is acceptable. And yeah, you know, nobody likes violence, but they're starting here saying, oh, if you're for violence, that's not Christian. Well, you know, actually, violence at the right time and place is Christian, because Catholic doctrine has approved it time after time. And to give this overall, you know, veto of violence is simply not doctrine. But these guys are allowed to set the doctrine. So we're living in a society where it's supposed to be separation of church and state. It only works one way. The churches don't get to influence the public officials, but more importantly, and the public officials get to influence the churches, but more importantly, the churches don't get to influence the powerful private interests. And the powerful private interests pipe the tune that the churches dance to. That's why they're all talking about gay rights and gay marriage, and that's why at the bishops' conference in Rome a month ago, they didn't want to talk about homosexuality or same-sex attraction. They don't want to talk about that because the 1% doesn't want them talking about that. That's what it's about.
Well, yeah, the global homo agenda is the agenda that you speak of, because that's the ultimate destruction or deracination or destruction of identity. And also, well, you mentioned, you know, this sort of this... this culling of the herd, this sort of war in the lower classes, and how they were kind of tricked into doing it to themselves, because this is done through a proliferation of pornography, sexual liberation, as a political weapon for enslavement, and you know, it was, I think, Michel Foucault who in Death Valley made that deal with the oligarchs that he would push sexual liberation over, you know, traditional left agitation about wages and workers' rights, because as long as people are engaging in free love and sexual liberation, they're going to be beguiled by that. And they're not going to agitate. They're not going to have families that form that they need to protect. They're not going to have communities. So that's the ultimate atomization. That's what, you know, we're seeing in society in general. And that's why you have sort of, you know, this gay agenda being and gay rights agenda or gay marriage, even transgender agenda being pushed by corporations and the oligarchs, because it's a way to destroy communities and families. From which real resistance can be developed to the globalist agenda. Yeah, and look what's happening. I mean, go across the Atlantic Ocean to what happened to Ireland. They needed the economic bubble to destroy the culture, and now, you know, abortion has been passed through a referendum there, and the people there are celebrating their own demise as they abort their own people and import foreigners to destroy Irish identity. Similar things are occurring in America. It's a different demographic, so it's occurring at a different pace. But it's, again, it's this, I guess, liberal mindset that seeks lower wages, lower costs, at the expense of the the native, at the host culture. They don't seem to care about the long term consequences, or they do. Maybe they want something completely different. You know.
Well, it's a remaking of the world. It's a remaking of societies, but they keep getting this pushback. You know, from ethnic, it keeps coming up. There is a white identity. There is a black identity.
Mm-hmm.
That's a reality, especially in America. Because I just go to a football game. I go to Notre Dame and watch a football. Just watch people walk around. There's a large foreign contingent of people there. They walk, act, talk differently than the Americans do.
Mm-hmm.
You can just see it because they are different. Okay. So, but you do have an identity that tries to emerge here. And the church has just been silent on it. The church has said nothing. The church can tip the balance here. And the elites know that.
Well, they've been complicit Europe, you know, where the Pope...
They've been complicit in America.
Yeah, they're encouraging mass migration at the expense of their own parishes. They did the same thing in the 60s when they were taken in by the cult of integration, which destroyed the ethnic neighborhoods. You know, what happened in Philadelphia is a great example of the political impact of that when the Catholic neighborhoods were broken up, and from those Catholic neighborhoods, the Irish Catholic neighborhoods, there was political resistance to the contraceptive agenda in the state of Pennsylvania. And when they gerrymandered those districts or integrated those districts out of existence, they broke the political resistance to that agenda, to that program, and they got, you know, they were able to eventually get these things approved. So there's a real consequence to these things, and that did go back to ethnic identity, because you have concentration in these parishes where the church could.
But it's ultimately, it's not about sex. It's not about sex.
Mm-hmm.
Sex is the red herring that draws everybody in. It's about making money and power. That's mm-hmm. what it's about.
Yes, sex is used as a weapon to beguile you and trick you. But you make the point in the article where among pro-life Catholics, the issue of pro-life defines whether or not you're a Christian or a Catholic. And if you're pro-abortion, you're not a true Christian or a Catholic. And they'll talk about that all day and debate that, and maybe that's worth debating. But no one really gets into the fundamental question of what's the ideal social organization for society. What really creates the good society? And you go in your articles, the Catholic Church's position traditionally has been the confessional state, and they've abandoned that position to promote liberalism. So they're abandoning their own teachings to promote the liberal order so they can, you know, be in tight with the oligarchs.
Well, so they can live well, and that's right. They don't want to rock the boat. That's why I'm calling for a Vatican III.
You sure you want to stir that nest?
Yeah, well, first we probably need to remove all the Catholic bishops in the United States, include archbishops, cardinals, and the Pope. They all need to resign. And then after that, maybe we can get down to the business of setting out clear positions doctrinally where people know what is required for the proper organization of society.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the idea of the oligarchs or the elite always wanted a, you know, this idea of non-establishment or the First Amendment, where there's no established religion. This was done to get religion out of the way so they can make money. And so we're told, at least in liberalism, we're told that the process works, that we don't need hierarchy or authority if we have the vote and freedom of speech, where we can work these things out. And apparently the genius of the people who resolve these matters worked out through the electoral process. Now, we all know that's really not the case. And you contrast that to the more traditional idea where we need hierarchy and authority. Can you kind of elaborate on the difference between the two?
Yeah. You need a hierarchy, you need authority, you need an established church, because it is an issue, not just of doctrine and dogma and Catholic teaching. I hesitate to use that word because teaching is such an abused word, but it's a part of doctrine and dogma of Catholicism, that you have an established religion and established church, which is the Catholic Church and Catholicism. That's a doctrine, but it's also a matter of good policy. It protects people. It's good for the entire society, because it's a check on the power of government, and it's a check on the power and the appetites of those who may become elites. That is the value of the confessional church. And ultimately, who it protects is the little guy and the little gal. It's all those people sitting tonight in that gymnasium at Holy Cross College, people who work hard, who want to know the right thing and do the right thing, who raise their kids thinking that I want them to know and do the right thing, you know, and get along with people and have a good life and then see God when this life is over. It's all those people who are worthy of protection because of their sincerity, because of their dedication to the truth, because it's just in their trust. Even if it is somewhat childlike, it's still a trust that can't be betrayed. And this Pope and the cardinals and the bishops have time after time betrayed that trust, and they've let the wolf in to devour these people. And that is what's wrong, and that is what has to happen when you establish a state church, because you provide a check on these powerful interests that do not care about the people, but only care about the bottom line. They only care about making money. This idea that we don't need a state church, that the religions will just be active and free in society, and they're going to be able to just simply carry on and teach the people to do the right thing, is bunk. It's bunk. Because what happens after a while, as I've said before, and as the evidence shows, is that you have the powerful private interest, the rich people, tell the church bishops and leaders what to do, because you got no established religion. Most importantly, you got religious liberty. That means that your people can pick and choose what church they want to be in. Okay? So, oh, wait a minute. 500 people come across the threshold this weekend. Only 100 are going to come next weekend because you said the wrong thing about such and such a topic. Okay. They get that. The church leaders get that. And so that's the power of the powerful private interest when there's no established church and there's no established religion. I mean, you know, at the same time, we're told this idea, oh, well, you know, the people will just know the right thing to do. Well, that may be. But you know what? You also need the power structures that make sure that their civil authorities do the right thing. There's Ireland. You spoke about Ireland. No state established church. They voted for abortion, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, well, don't the people know the right thing? If abortion is against the natural law, don't they know the right thing? They should have voted against it, right? Okay, so that shoots that idea down the drain, that people are going to simply vote in accordance with the natural law. They will still organize and act in some inchoate sense of the natural law, which is what we're seeing, you know, with this identity, these ethnic identities that are trying to rise in America. They will do that. But, you know, they need somebody to help them along that road. And that's what the state established church does. Then we're told this idea of, you know, if we just sit down and talk with different points of views, you know, we can work it all out and it'll be fine. We'll come to the truth and we'll just follow it. You know, now I got to make one personal observation. I was in LA during the riots in 1992. I was there, and it was a terrifying time because You had the forces of disorder coming out from one part of L.A., surging into the western part of L.A., which was the well-heeled area. Okay, and they were starting to come up into Hollywood Hills and Bel Air and all those places. Okay, and that was pretty serious. That got a lot of people's attention. Okay, because these forces of disorder were very much bent on creating a lot of mayhem and violence. They burned, they shot, they killed, they beat, they stole, and so on and so forth. And it was a scary time. They finally had to call in, you know, the National Guard and regular army troops. And they had to patrol that city with guys with automatic weapons, with curfews during the daytime in Los Angeles, California, United States of America. That was the situation, okay? And one thing that diffused the whole thing was what Rodney King said. And I don't mean this in any way other than he said it, and it really did diffuse the situation. He said, "Can't we get along?" And everybody just stopped what they were doing at that point. But that's one instance, and that's a severe instance. But when you're dealing with a situation where you've got people trying to earn a living, and they hold these really disparate views, and they're trying to carry on their life, and you've got this overarching philosophy that says, well, you know, we can just work it out. We'll just get to know what the truth is, and we'll follow it. That's a pretty radical revolutionary idea in all of history. Yeah, it doesn't normally work that way. Usually somebody with the power walks in and says, this is the way it's going to be. Now, the power dynamics and the power tools are different in America now. They're used more subtly. They're used through the media. But it's still used by the powerful to control the thoughts of those who aren't powerful.
Yeah, and that's, of course, obviously, yeah, the entertainment, movies, music, just, you know, the various memes and ideas that are put forth out there. And it is very subtle and very effective. But yet, in your, you know, you talk about in the article, it's the union is stronger. It's divided. No one's getting along. We all disagree. But the union is stronger than ever because the union is sort of based on the constant sort of this low grade constant conflict, keeping everyone divided, preventing certain sections from cohering, providing some resistance to the center or from you know, from the capital or from the oligarchs or the elite. So there's in a certain way, the way that things are unfolding now, I think there's a certain amount of intent here because they want the conflict. They want a sort of tension, you know, to be constantly created. So people are constantly divided and fighting with each other. It's a divide and conquer strategy.
Yeah, it's a managed conflict. That's exactly right. They've managed the conflict to take people's eyes off the big issues. And unfortunately, that's what the pro-life movement is. It's supposed to take your eye off the big issue, you know, which is how could such a law be constitutional? I mean, how could such a decision be reached? I mean, I mean, you can look at the American founding, look at the Constitution, look at the organizational documents. It makes perfect sense. But how can Catholics, knowing that and seeing that, not say, wait a minute, society is not supposed to be organized this way. You're supposed to have laws that prevent that from happening. None of the Catholics say that. I mean, you'll have Catholics speak against abortion and maybe they'll hit now at some point outlawing abortion, but you know, basically all they're trying to do is limit it right now. And certainly nobody in the Catholic Church with any authority is talking about reexamining the First Amendment and the system of social organization in this society, because it's the First Amendment that strikes at the heart of Catholic social doctrine. That's the issue right there. Free religion, no state religion, no state church, privately owned free press. Power of private interests run the show right there.
So what American Catholics have to think about, cogitate over, chew on, is the fact that the founding one of the founding principles of the American state, the First Amendment, is a contradiction of Catholic doctrine, and there's no way you can reconcile those things other than just ignore it the way the, you know, or abandon it the way the Catholic hierarchy has done, the Catholic Church leadership has done. They've been captured by America, as you say. They're in their American captivity. Nevertheless, if, let's say hypothetically, if the Church in America taught this, taught that the goal of the Catholic Church is to evangelize and convert America to Catholicism in pursuit of creating a state church, and let's say that's their goal, and Catholic, and most Catholics were aware of this, and this is how, this is their political view based on how their consciences were informed by Catholic doctrine. Assuming, you know, the 35-40% of the population, plurality perhaps, not a majority, what type of alchemical effect or leavening effect would they have on American society in general? I'm not saying that necessarily that goal even has to be achieved. I'm thinking if a Catholics were solid in this view, other than, I mean, short of achieving that goal, there would be resistance to things like abortion and contraception, gay rights, gay marriage, and all the other degenerate things that would be promoted by the American state and corporations, because they could boycott the same way as they kept Hollywood on a leash back in the, you know, through the 30s into the 60s because of ethnic consciousness. They were able to boycott movies. And so the production code lived in fear of the Legions of Decency, which was sort of the teeth, the enforcement mechanism for that. You could have a similar type of thing going on in American society, not quite censorship, but nevertheless, it's broad, this sort of the strong consciousness where they'd have a direct effect on public policy in a way that would make the elites, that would check the elites. You see what my point is?
Well, I think in a way, I think a lot of the things that you talked about, you know, the production code and abortion, contraception, all that stuff, I think those are all symptoms. I mean, and so what the Catholic response has been is to deal with the symptoms. Mm-hmm. And that's an Americanist response in itself. They don't deal with the root cause. All those things arise simply because of the structure. So if a Catholic leader is going to speak out against this system of societal organization, well, I mean, he's going to be martyred. Okay. It's that simple. You know, and if you're a laity and you speak out against it, well, that's the end of your career, buddy. I mean, you might be able to get a job as a day laborer somewhere, but, you know, that's pretty much the end of your career. But that's called martyrdom. And, you know, in the Roman Empire, there were a lot of guys and gals who just said, yeah, you know, we're just not for this, you know, burning incense at this altar, you know, and they got fed to the lions or, you know, and it's like at the time it was just great fun. But from that arose a greater awakening, a spiritual awakening. And, you know, they say the blood of the martyrs is the seed of Christians, you know. So what you had is by people suffering for the faith, then great good comes from it. From evil, there always comes good.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's what you're dealing with. I mean, if the Catholic religion, Catholicism is right, you know, I'm sure that's what you teach your children. You know, if that's right, then that's what you got to do. But, but, you know, you do that, your kids are not probably going to have a better life than the parents.
And of course,
probably not going to happen unless they reject the parents. You know, I suppose they could advance that way.
With, you know, I guess with exemplars of Catholicism like Dolan or Supich, they're not really into martyrdom. My impression is they're not too anxious to be martyred for the faith.
I think Dolan would probably die for a good stake. I think he would. I think he would, yeah. I mean, this guy came to Notre Dame years ago, and he said, people ask me what it takes to be a Catholic. And he said, all you got to do is just smile. Smile! What? So, you know, this is the leadership now. I mean, these guys are, they're politicians. They serve the 1%, and that's not going to change. And, you know, I'm sorry to talk about them this way, but some of us know too much.
Your remedy at the end of the article was very, very provocative, but I have to say I do like it, because a cleaning of house has to be in order. And when you go and you alluded to it earlier, but you're talking about how the leadership needs to be scrapped and priests have to work and these things? Do you want to talk about that? That's because that gets like that's like old school stuff, right?
Well, it's just general. It's just general ideas on how to clean up the church, but it's organizational. You see it in business, you know. You see it in the military. You see it in every human organization. Well, guess what? The church has got a human component to it. Okay, and so what you got to do is you got to clean up the leadership. Every organization is run from the top. Everyone. Don't believe this stuff about, oh, the grassroots are going to tell us what to do. No, the grassroots are going to tell the people at top how best to control the grassroots. That's what is happening. Okay, let's be real about this. So you got to clean up the organization. You got to clean up these bishops that stand there. The only time they get on TV is to talk about sex abuse and to talk about raising money for Catholic schools. Again, two very Americanist points of view. Incredibly Americanist, you know, schools and sexual issues. We're going to talk about those two things, you know, and that's all they talk about. They stand there with the perfectly white teeth and this big sash around the middle and their traditional bishop garb, and they say nothing. They just smile. Well, these guys have all got to go. Okay, they got to go because they don't care about the people in the pews. Oh, they care as long as you're giving them money, you know, and you got to keep them relevant by bringing your kids in and stuff like that. They care, but you know, beyond that, no, they don't care. You know, you're on your own. Listen to Hollywood or New York; they know better. You know, so and by that I mean, you know, the secular authorities. I don't mean any group of people. I mean the secular authorities. You know, secular world. So you know, go with those guys. And so that's what they say. So the leadership's got to go. And, you know, clearly after the talk from John Allen tonight, I reinforced my belief that the leadership of the U.S. has got to go first. Everybody's got to go. Everybody's got to go. And then Rome's got to go, which reported, you know, 80% of the people there, according to that one author, are considered gay. 80%? I mean, that's huge. So then you get rid of them. And I think that what you have to do is before – the church is, you know, the Catholic Church is allowed to have these fantastic, giant buildings and my God, I mean, these huge complexes where the retreat centers and all this stuff needs to be severed from the leadership, put into a trust. It can be liquidated as needed to pay the cost, to benefit the Catholics who are hurt for standing up for the faith, those Catholics who need the support of the church, because that's how the church grew in Rome, okay? It grew that way because you had the church leaders, the bishops providing for the people who were just simply cut off, had no support. They were actually provided for materially by the church. So the church needs to get into providing for Catholic people because they're Catholic people. Okay, so then, you know, we get rid of the leadership, we alienate their property. I mean, they can still, you know, care for the sick and stuff, but we really need to relook that whole model because you have organizations called Franciscan Hospital, you know, mega corporate complex that basically is in there just doing incredible work and making money. Advancing anything other than healthcare, but you know, they do some good too. But you got to get rid of this corporate model that is oriented towards you know, making money. But you have to get them in there, you know, to care for people. So that's essential. And then you need to we need to have when the church is established and they can build their cathedrals and they can build, you know, their palaces for the priests to live in. Until that time, you know, guess what? You know, you're going to be like St. Paul. You're going to work for a living, you know, and you're going to have to do manual labor because people who do manual labor tend to be more masculine. I mean, that's the bottom line with guys. And the whole issue with gay is not so much the sodomy. I think the sodomy, you know, is what, when you talk about sodomy, that attracts people. They get all fired up about that because that's sex. Oh, yeah. But what you're talking about is you're talking about role reversal or role confusion. And you're getting the effeminacy of men.
Yeah.
And I think if you're a Catholic and you take a look at the gospel and you look at the faith, there's a doctrinal, if not dogmatic, basis for how the genders are supposed to exist.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there are issues. I know, I understand there are biological and physical issues that may occur where there are crossovers between the genders. But is that really supposed to be a central issue of the church leadership at any time? And can't we really resolve that on a lesser level and deal with that on a lesser level? You know, can't we deal just like the whole issue of the rising, you know, identity of the gays and the treatment of the gays? I mean, isn't that something that should be dealt with, you know, on another level, and not be made centerpiece of what the church talks about anymore, of its inclusiveness? I mean, that's just an example. But I mean, there's a lot of other instances like that. You're dealing with basic effeminacy. You're dealing with a basic organization of society along the lines of a family, and a larger society that's based along the lines of the family too, which is authoritarian. I think that comes out of Catholic doctrine and Catholic dogma. And how do you avoid that? I don't know. Now, I think that secular society has done some good things in that it has dealt with psychological issues. People deal with various psychological issues and psychological problems. And I think there's a lot of wisdom that can actually be gained from the psychological sciences and from the psychiatric sciences, because a lot of people don't know how to deal with various emotions and things. And some of that is biologically based, and that has to be dealt with appropriately. So there are good things that are being taken. Those are my provocative comments at this point in time.
And of course, an example of an institution that's really lost its ways is something like Notre Dame University, which, you know, now is a huge, in your neighborhood there, which sits on a huge endowment, yet charges $60,000-$70,000 a year for people to attend. It's no longer a Catholic institution.
Yeah, I think they got $15 billion. Their budget's bigger than the Vatican. But that's, you know, that's it. I mean, but that's, you know, that's how you think. And it's, you know what? It's a good school. It's a good school. You know what? You go there, you play the game, you can move up. You can move up. Yeah. I mean, but you want to go to Harvard and Yale and Princeton, but don't cheat. You know, you want to go there because that'll definitely get you in the top tier. But you can go to Notre Dame, just, you know, check your Catholicism out there. Yeah, go to church once in a while with, have a crucifix in your office or whatever, and yeah, you'll be fine. You can move up.
Mm-hmm. And so the article is the State of the Union. It's available at the American Proposition website, correct?
Yep. You can read it there in all of its glory.
Anything else? I think we covered it, or?
I think we covered everything. I want to thank you for having me on. I know it's getting a little late, and unfortunately, I got to get up early tomorrow to travel.
Okay, listen, you have a safe trip. I want to thank you for coming back on the show. That's great. Of course, David Wemhoff, the author of John Courtney Murray, Time, Life, and the American Proposition, How the CIA's Doctrinal Warfare Changed the Catholic Church. I've read it, and I'd say it's probably one of the most important books that have been written in the past 50 years.
Thank you very much. I greatly appreciate that, Tim. And thank you for having me on your show.
Thank you. Good night. And when I post this, I'll send you the link.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Good night. Bye-bye.